was a new person. I can tell you the whole story.
Yeah.
And
they look like they're doing so.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
We call the Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance Committee to order. We'll start off with the roll call.
Johnson.
Here.
Lohmer.
Here.
Hillstrom.
Here.
Becker Finn.
Here.
Considine. Dean.
Here.
Frankie.
Here.
Grossel. Howe. Lucero. Newberger. O'Neill.
Here.
Pinto. Ooglin.
Here.
Ward.
Here.
Zerwas.
Here.
Representative O'Neill, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes from yesterday?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the minutes from March 27th.
Representative O'Neill moves the minutes from March 27th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motions are approved, or minutes are approved. Representative Hillstrom. This morning we'll start out with House File 3231, and we'll be laying this bill over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Members, at one point in time, 5 years ago, I was the chair of the Public Safety Committee, Finance Committee, and we created a court technology fee. It came about because the court was going to e-filing and doing all filing pieces online, and all of the partners didn't have access to new technology as well, and there was no funding for those people. So we created a court technology fund to enable partners to apply for a grant to help make this transition to all technology go much smoother. There is a report that you should have received that tells you what they've done over the last 5 years with the money. Members, there have been more than 61 applications for this grant funding, and that would total over $8,851,301 just in applications. And they actually awarded 34 projects for a total of $2,663,519. I would like this process to continue and eliminate the sunset on the fee. It was for 5 years. It clearly has been very successful, and that's all it does is eliminate the sunset, Mr. Chair.
Any questions from the members? Anyone from the public wish to testify on this bill? Okay, with that, the bill will be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hortman, welcome to the committee. At this time, we'll hear House File 3465, which will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if Representative Portman would move my bill.
Mr. Chair, I certainly would. As a co-author of this bill, I would move the bill forward.
Thank you. Representative Hope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Representative Uglum and I represent the city of Coon Rapids, and we have an individual in the city who came forward and made us aware of a problem in state law. Currently, under state law, it's a complete defense to certain criminal sexual conduct allegations to state that the individuals are married. And in a particular case that was brought to our attention, a woman was drugged and raped and wanted to bring charges against the perpetrator. And a prosecuting attorney had to dismiss the charges because of this statutory provision. And the case couldn't even go forward to be considered. And so I did a little research, and it seemed to me that this particular section of law serves no purpose and that we should delete it from the statutes. And here, to speak from a more informed standpoint and more knowledge on the issue is Caroline Palmer with the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault.
Ms. Palmer, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Caroline Palmer. I'm the Public and Legal Affairs Manager at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. We do support this bill and thank Representative Portman and Representative Ugum for bringing it forward. We really appreciate it. This particular statute section has actually long been a curiosity from Minnesota's standpoint. It does present a bar to prosecution in instances that would normally fall under the criminal sexual conduct statute, such as age difference involving minors, or mental impairment, incapacitation, physical helplessness of the victim, and also a special transportation driver exception, too, when the parties are married or cohabitating. This bar, on occasion, has prevented the prosecution of cases in our state, as Representative Portman described. I think it also sends a very strange message about the circumstances under which we will or will not address sexual assault in a relationship. The statute does allow for prosecution when there is a divorce in progress or separate living conditions, but overall the exceptions stated in the statute essentially add up to a marital or relationship rape loophole in our laws. We have discussed the statute as a group at MnCASA with prosecutors, as well as a representative from the Disability Law Center. We wanted to ensure that repealing the law would in no way take away from consensual relationships between persons with cognitive or physical disabilities. It was the consensus of our work group that the repeal will not have that unintended consequence. Significant effort has been made across the 50 states toward the end of the 20th century to remove allowances for marital rape in the law. And Minnesota did that as well. However, we still have this sort of odd section that provides an out. It really is a rather significant out for a perpetrator in a marriage or cohabitating relationship, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Any questions from the members? Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I, again, want to thank the authors for bringing this forward. And just wanted to emphasize that rape and sexual assault definitely do happen within relationship, marital relationships and other close relationships. And also wanted to highlight that, you know, filing for divorce and starting those proceedings and taking the steps to end a relationship is the time that's most women are most in danger of being killed by their partners. And so this is a really important step to address these behaviors that are happening even while they're technically still married. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would also like to thank the author for bringing it forward. Recently was interviewed by some high school students as to why I had signed on to a current ERA bill, and one of the things I referenced was this bill and some of the other antiquated laws that are still on our books. But again, thank you for bringing this forward.
Representative Glassman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think you can answer this. How many of these cases are being handled in the state? Do you have any kind of idea?
Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Grossell, the fiscal note I found interesting because it kind of gave us an idea of how many more prosecutions it thought that the department thought would go forward. It's a fairly small number of increased prosecutions and then therefore a need for beds in the correctional facilities. Pretty small fiscal note. So I think in one area of the law, the belief was there'd be a need for four additional prison beds. And then I think in another area of the law, there was another one or more. So not a ton. But a few. And in the case that was brought to our attention, really an injustice has been committed and there is no redress because of this section of statute. So when I saw the fiscal note, you know, I was a little bit, we all have pause, right, when there's a fiscal note for legislation that we bring forward. And I thought, well, this is the kind of thing that we should spend money on, right, is putting people who have committed a crime in our correctional facilities.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. That's kind of what I was asking about. But do you have any numbers that you can get an idea that you can give us of how much is this happening? I know it's a small number, but
it's important to just kind of have an idea. Because as you know, a lot of my legislation has been geared towards protecting and stopping this very type of activity, whether it's through criminal sexual conduct, assault, all of this stuff, child pornography, all of it. So, we're pretty much on the same sheet of music when it comes to this type of crime. So, but that's, if you don't have a concrete number right now, that's okay too.
Representative Putman?
I think Ms. Palmer has some data.
Ms. Palmer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Russell, I don't really have a whole lot of information. All I can kind of go off is the cases that I've heard over the time I've been at MnCASA. And I think in total I've heard about this happening about 4 or 5 times over the past 10 years. So it doesn't happen a lot. But when it does happen, I think the prosecutor's offices who were involved felt terrible because they couldn't do something about it.
And that's not counting what was unreported.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Just one case is one too many.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just note that I've been working with MnCASA on this for a little while. I attended the meeting with the disability community and others as well. And this has been something that's been held up for a while with a number of concerns. And then we kind of reached a point in that meeting and saying, shouldn't it just be repealed? And so I'm grateful to the minority leader for bringing this forward, too. And I think it's a great bill. Thank you.
Thank you for being my technical advisor on this area as well.
Representative Rubin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I mean, this is a loophole in the law that has to be closed. So just one case is too many. Granted, there's only a few that are happening around the state, but I'm sure there are more that are not reported. And that's the big thing. Representative Hortman and I feel very strongly about this bill, and I hope that everybody will vote for it.
Okay, any public testimony on this bill? Okay, Representative Portman, any last remarks?
Well, I'd just like to thank the individual who brought this to our attention, and I think that our constituents should know that when they see an injustice, when they can bring the injustice to their state representatives and give us really specific information, that sometimes we're able to help out. And so thank you to the individual for being willing to approach us with this delicate situation and ask for our help.
Well, thank you. And we will be laying this bill over for possible inclusion. Thank you. Okay, next we'll have House File 2795, Representative Loon. Representative Bloom, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair moves that House File 2795 will be re-referred to Education Finance. We have two amendments. We'll start with the A4 first. Do you want to explain a little bit of that? And
yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Jennifer Loon. And so I have two amendments to propose to House File 2795, and I think it may make sense. I'll describe the amendments briefly and then talk about the bill afterwards, if that suits you, Mr. Chair.
That would be fine.
All right. So the A4 amendment addresses some concerns or suggestions that have been raised by stakeholders regarding the legislation, and so including the professional educator licensing standards board, or we call it PELSB, has recommended some flexibility in using third party option for a periodic background check that I'm proposing. Right now, when teachers are licensed, there is an extensive background check done for initial licensure, but nothing after that. And PELSB has approached me about some a system that they may be looking to subscribe to and that they would pay for out of their existing budget, and so that that could be utilized when teachers have to apply for their relicensure every 5 years, that they could employ that system rather than having to do an entirely new BCA and FBI fingerprinting check. So that would, this language would incorporate their ability to do that. And they have talked to me about this and have language to that effect in some proposed rules that they're working on. Next, make sure that we're applying these standards both equally to PELSB and also to the Board of School Administrators, so just to make clear that they're both under the same standards. And again, we're deleting the reference to the BCA for the periodic check that would occur in every 5 years when a teacher applies for relicensure. And again, aligning the original bill said 3 to 5 years. We're making it 5 years because that is consistent with the relicensure time frame for teachers. So that is basically the A4 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Any questions on the A4 amendment from the members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Now we have the A7 amendment. Chair will move the A7 amendment.
All right, Mr. Chair, the A7 amendment addresses some concerns in including stays of adjudication, which would information would be now pulled when a background check is done on someone applying for a teaching license. And these are stays of adjudication for disqualifying offenses under Section 122A.20. The amendment would limit the stays of adjudication to offenses that are ostensibly crimes against persons. There were some concerns raised about maybe property crimes or certain types of theft. And so the new language would still bring those stays of adjudication offenses into the background check. And those stays that would require a predatory offender registration or another offense in Section 122A20 Subdivision 1 would be included, but not including things in the original bill, such as presenting false claims to defraud, medical assistance fraud, theft, embezzlement of public funds. So those would not be automatic disqualifiers for someone applying for a teaching license, but it would provide that information to go to the professional licensing board, and they would have discretion to decide if they wanted to issue a license to someone who had that in their background. And again, this is an attempt to try to strike a compromise between, again, trying to make sure that we are examining people's history, their characters, and things that, and their fitness for teaching in our schools, but maybe drawing a difference between things that would be considered predatory offenses and things that would fall more under theft or types of property crimes. And again, we would align the application of the stays of adjudication to the background studies required for school bus drivers to offenses requiring predatory offender registration. And also that alignment is every 4 years when a school bus driver has to apply for their commercial driver's license, and they go through that check at that time.
Any questions from the members? Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is that the teacher would be responsible for paying for these background checks.
Representative Bloom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, so when a teacher applies for a license the first time, they are responsible for the cost of that check. In the amendment that I'm proposing and in discussions with PELSB, or the Educator Licensing Standards Board, they are looking at subscribing to a system that they would pay for that could run a check. It wouldn't be the full BCA, FBI fingerprint check, which you do have to do the first time you apply for licensure, but on renewal, they could use this system that they are paying for. So I wouldn't anticipate a cost to teachers, and also this bill is going to come to the Education Finance Committee, and so we are going to fully explore whether there would be any additional cost required that we would have to make funding available for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm thinking of Sister Mary Barbara, one of my favorite teachers, who also had a vow of poverty in her life. That would be rather difficult for her to come up with money for something else like this. And I guess I would be really concerned if she would have to pay for a background check every couple of years and wonder where she would have to come up with the money. So, yes, I would really hope that that would not be the case. So, as you're going forward.
Mr. Chair and Representative Considine, well, yes, and we are mindful of those concerns. And again, in working with Pelsby, we're trying to figure a system out where there would be no cost to teachers for doing this periodic check with their relicensure.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative DeLune, I just want a clarification on page 3 in looking at the amendments. Maybe I'm still missing it. Line 24 on page 3. When you
I'm sorry, are you talking about page 3 of the bill?
Or yes, of the bill. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
And I was making the notes on the amendments. So the renewal license is every 5 years. Is that correct?
Representative Lynn?
Yes, that's correct, Representative Ward.
Representative Ward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then I'm wondering if on line 3.24 on the bill, if that's, I'm sorry, it does say 5 years. I was thinking that it was, you were shipped, it slipped to 3. All right. So it is 5 years that the teachers renew, right? Okay. I'm good then. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to ask a couple of questions as soon as we adopt the amendment. It's not specifically on the amendment, so maybe we should do that and then talk to the bill.
Representative Gossel. Thank you, Representative Moon, for getting the state's adjudication portion in there and making sure that, just like the language says, received a state adjudication for an offense that if convicted would require predatory offender registration under the sections. It's important, excuse me, it's important that these types of persons' crimes are eliminated so that, again, we can put the best teachers in front of our students and not someone who is flying on the radar with something like that in their criminal history. Again, state of adjudication. It might not be a strong case for the prosecution to go forward with, but the defense looks at that evidence and says, if this case goes forward, I could be prosecuted fully for this. So it is not an innocent party that has received the state of adjudication, though it's not a conviction. So thank you for putting that in there. All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Representative Loon, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And let me talk to, I'll try to be brief and not give you, overwhelm you with details. But I just wanted to set the stage for why I'm offering this bill and why I think it's important. I first want to emphasize that we have over 50,000 teachers in the state of Minnesota, and they are amazing, wonderful people by and large. But unfortunately, occasionally we have to write legislation to address very unusual or rare instances that occur, but they do occur and are things that we don't want happening in our schools and maybe people who we would not want to be teachers in front of our children in our classrooms. And so what I'm proposing to do is to make some changes, and some of them have been brought to light, unfortunately, in very public ways, in news stories that have done some digging on incidences where people have been licensed to teach and in light of some very disturbing activities that I think should have disqualified them from teaching. And so I think these are some areas of the law that deem strengthening, and that's what we're trying to do with House Bill 2795. So There is a teacher code of ethics that exists in rule, and so I would take those rules, put them in the statute, codify them, but would add a prohibition on sexual contact with students. That wasn't a specific item listed in the code of ethics, and so it would state that students of any age would be off limits for sexual contact with their teacher or a teacher in their school. And I think that's an important addition. With the amendment added, there would be a periodic criminal background check every 5 years, so not just the initial one when you're licensed for the first time. But again, with the amendment, I think there's a way to do that through Pell's fee, through a system that they're looking at employing, so it would be at no cost to the teacher. And it would coincide with the 5-year renewal that teachers must do for their licensure. We would repeal current law, which would allow someone to begin working in a school while they were still waiting for their criminal background study to be completed. This was actually a suggestion brought to me by Pelsby. I think it makes perfect sense that we wouldn't allow someone to start working in a school until that check had been completed and we had that important information. Stays of adjudication right now do not pull forward with a criminal background check, and I'm proposing that they would. These stays of adjudication are for crimes subject to predatory offender registration or other offenses that would automatically disqualify someone for being allowed to be a teacher. It would deny or revoke a teaching license for any felony conviction or a gross misdemeanor involving a minor. A felony or gross misdemeanor involving a minor that is not on the list of automatic disqualifying offenses, there would be an option for an applicant to request consideration or reconsideration of their licensure for good cause. So again, it does give the board some discretion on felonies or gross misdemeanors involving children, as long as those offenses are not an automatic disqualifier from employment or licensure as a teacher. Denies or revokes a teaching license to a teacher who engages in sexual conduct as defined under 609.321 subdivision 11 with a student enrolled in the school where the teacher works or volunteers. And again, this also gets to incidences where a relationship has been revealed between a teacher and the student is the age of 18 or perhaps older. We do allow students to stay in public schools up through age 21, and I believe strongly that it is never appropriate for a teacher to engage in a sexual relationship with a student, even if they're 18 or 19 or 20, if they're in the school where they work. So this would make that clear. It doesn't criminalize it, but it does disqualify you from getting a teaching license if you do that. Most of the other things we've talked about, and so maybe it would be best if we just open it up for questions if members have specific questions about this, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loon, we had some conversations in civil law about some of the disqualifying offenses. And so I just want to make the record really clear. So right now the department has some discretion in who they issue licenses to and who they don't, especially specifically talking about the section of the theft statute that's included under their ability for complaints and investigations. So under the rules right now, the board shall initiate a proceeding to suspend or revoke a license or should refuse to renew a license under certain statutes, and one of them is the entire theft statute, which includes all misdemeanor thefts, and there's no look-back time period. So if you're taking away some of the discretion of the board to do set-asides, what is your position on the set-asides for some of these minor thefts? How far do you look back? If they've been a teacher for 30 years and they committed a misdemeanor theft when they were 18, do you expect that they're going to be losing their license?
Representative Bloom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom. So I know when you were mentioning this before, are you talking about the offense listed in Section 214.10, Subdivision 2A?
Yes.
Okay. So, and I might have nonpartisan staff, Ms. Christina Parra, come forward. And just to be, because I wanted to, I went back to talk with her about this, and our committee administrator did, and it's our belief that this is not new language, but it is a new cross-reference in the section, but these offenses are currently and were, are currently now, before any change in the law, disqualifiers from getting a teaching license. But what is new is the cross-reference. But I want Ms. Parra to make sure I'm not misstating this.
Welcome. Please state your name for the record and continue.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm Christina Parra from House Research. Yes, Section 122A07 states that Pelsby Subdivision 4 says that the review and processing of complaints, setting of fees, and certain other things are as provided in Chapter 214. So unless something in Chapter 122A states otherwise. So all those offenses that are in Section Chapter 214, those are already, those provisions already apply to Pelsby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But the problem is that right now the board has the discretion to waive those, and what this bill is doing is taking away additional board discretion. Isn't that the bottom line in saying under certain circumstances you no longer can waive these considerations?
Ms. Parra?
Compulsory revocation, in a sense.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hellstrom, those are... I'm just looking for the reference to Chapter 214. Yes, those are now included in the automatic refusal under Section... under that paragraph B that lists those clauses. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you, Madam, Mr. Chair. Sorry. And there's no look-back period defined in the bill. So anyone who's ever committed a misdemeanor theft, whether it was 40 years ago or 30 years ago, now would be an automatic compulsory revocation.
Ms. Parra?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hellstrom, yes, the statute doesn't it simply lists the offenses. It doesn't give any kind of look back, like as you were referring to it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to continue on that. So if I'm a teacher and I've been teaching 20 or 30 years and I've been, you know, I did something when I was 18, a small theft, it's on my record, and the board all these previous times have looked at that and said, well, that's not an issue, you're a great teacher, you're going to continue to teach. The next time my renewal comes up, they're going to have to deny my license.
Ms. Parra? Representative
Dean? Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, these things are going to be less discretion for the board, absolutely. But I think there are some decisions that have been made with the current discretion that the licensing board has that, in my mind, calls into question the use of this discretion. Again, a teacher was convicted in another state of fraud and money laundering and theft of $160,000 of money dedicated for basically food money for low-income food programs for students at a school, and was only denied a license for 2 years in the state of Minnesota and is currently teaching. I guess someone who steals that amount of money from a school and from a program from low-income children, it makes me wonder whether that person, should be licensed. Another person pleaded guilty to possession of 236 pounds of marijuana with intent to deliver, satisfy their conditions of probation, they were only prohibited from getting a license for 2 years and is teaching in a school. These are some things that I think call into question whether the use of that discretion, and so we are putting more constraints around that with the licensing board.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lynn. I haven't been here as long as you have. I've been here 6 years, but in that time I've learned that we can craft language to do the specific things that we wanted to do and exclude other things that we don't want to do. And I would contend that I certainly understand there are cases that are egregious, that fall under certain statutes, but there are ways in which we can do things in the event that, you know, a teacher has had a license renewed 3 or 4 times, that they would be excluded within certain areas of, you know, whether it's the theft area or something like that. So there are things we can do, and I believe that what we're doing is we're using a really, really big sword where we should be using a scalpel. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Loon, do you have any comments?
Well, I appreciate concerns that are raised, and again, I've tried to be mindful of the concerns that are raised, and we have made some adjustments to the bill with the amendments that were added. But again, I think we hold teachers in high regard, and we do have expectations of, and I think parents have expectations of knowing that we have done everything we can to ensure our children's safety, that we're placing them in good hands and someone who wouldn't perhaps pose a danger to them or a threat to them or is also a good role model for them. And again, I think some of these offenses that have occurred and people have still been licensed anyways under the current discretion gives me great pause as to whether or not there's enough guidance in the law to the licensing board of things that should be, it's not that I don't believe in redemption, it's just perhaps your place of employment should not be in a school teaching children. So. That's my position. I understand others may have questions about it, but again, I think there's been a great deal of concern about some of these cases that have been talked about very publicly, and the bill is attempting to tighten up some of those instances, some of which have led to, molestation of children, which may not have occurred if we had known some of this information going into their licensure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lynn, in this committee, we spend a lot of time talking about who should get a second chance and who shouldn't, who should forever be marked and who shouldn't. And this committee overwhelmingly doesn't usually consider misdemeanor theft to be a permanent marker on someone's record forever. This now says if you've ever, over the age of 18, if you've ever committed a misdemeanor theft, you cannot be a teacher, ever. We don't have that criteria for people we appoint to the bench to be judges, to make decisions about folks. We don't have that criteria for legislators. We don't have that criteria even for doctors and nurses, people who administer pain medication, people who have access to many, many things. I understand that there are conditions that people shouldn't teach, that they should not be in contact. I've been a prosecutor. I've prosecuted people who have stolen a lot of money, over $100,000. And so I get it when people are using manipulation and they are using their position of authority to do harm. But I know a whole lot of kids who, walked away from a restaurant and didn't pay their bill and got a misdemeanor theft because they didn't have the money when they were in college or maybe they had a little bit too much to drink, walked away and end up with a misdemeanor conviction for theft. $1.99 will get you a misdemeanor conviction for theft. And so I just don't know that we want to mark a student maybe or someone who's just over 18 who makes a mistake for the rest of their life and say, I'm sorry, but you can no longer ever be eligible to teach our children. I think we believe in this committee that people deserve redemption for certain kinds of things, and there are other provisions in this bill that you can say the line should be moved over or shouldn't be. I just think the theft statute and misdemeanor thefts is not one of them that this committee has ever said should be forever disqualifiers for anything.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Equating a major drug dealer with somebody that maybe shoplifted something 30 years ago just is wrong. I'm sorry. I love dear sister Barbara, but there was, I'm not so sure that maybe at some point in her life she didn't do something that might fall underneath this statute. I knew her, she was 70 years old. Good Lord, not teachers are not saints, and this is so broad that I cannot fathom saying, you know, somebody that had 230 pounds of marijuana is the same as somebody that shoplifted a candy bar. That's just beyond what I can think is even reasonable. Again, you know, I'm not trying to tell kids that the teachers are saints. This is not workable. I'm sorry, I cannot get behind a bill that does something like this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to note my colleagues have been focusing on more on the kind of crime, but it is, and this would reference to a bit, it's just the lack of a look-back period I find really, really troubling. Somebody may have been teaching, has been said, for 20 years, for 30 years. The offense may well have been committed decades earlier, and I'm not aware of other areas. So I guess to flip that around, when I think of situations where we look at past conduct and we're trying to think about how that might disqualify somebody now, we're usually going to take into account the time frame and take into account what has happened since then. I guess, and on top of everything else, that lack of a look-back period I find deeply troubling for how that might impact somebody who may well be doing extraordinary work in the classroom. And to have that lack indicates to me that, as was said, this ends up being sort of a not taking a focused and targeted and specific approach to this problem, but taking a much broader approach, and one that really is not warranted. And I want to note, in connection with that, Representative Gross and I have kind of gone back and forth on this, but when you pull in these stays of adjudication, it may well be that the effect for some people is going to be the effect that we're hoping for, that we're holding more people accountable. But we need to recognize that by removing that middle ground option, for prosecutors, for the justice system, we're going to cause some people to be not held accountable at all in ways that they are right now, because the case either isn't going to be charged or the case is going to end up resulting in an acquittal by not having that middle ground option. And by bringing that in here, we're once again eroding, trying to figure out a nuanced approach to problems, and instead having a much broader one that, that really does not fit. So I have deep concerns with the bill as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ward, just remind you, we have some testifiers left on this bill. We have another bill to go, and we have session in 1 hour.
One question. Having worked with youth and youth intervention programs and recognizing brain development, we know that young people who we consider adults, 18 to 24, 25, 26, do stupid things sometimes. And I'm hoping that maybe you would consider putting some guardrails on this so that we really had a look-back period that was appropriate, so we didn't, you know, take somebody out of the classroom who had a good record and did something stupid when they were immature. And maybe having a level of discretion, so that equating, as you said, the drugs or the fraud and that sort of thing being very different from a minor incident of shoplifting or walking away forgetting to pay for gas or something. Neglecting is very different than intentional theft or crime. So I wondered if you would please consider putting some guardrails in there that would satisfy the concerns that we have and allow teachers to stay in the classroom who've been there and are doing a good job.
Representative Bloom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I am always willing to listen to suggestions from colleagues about, you know, how we can appropriately craft legislation, again, to go, in this case, to make sure that we are screening out people who would not, I think, in the sensibility of most parents, would not be appropriate to be in the classroom, from people who made perhaps a youthful mistake. I do think there are certain things, even if they were done in youth, you know, it should disqualify you. I guess I am, you know, in adjusting the bill on stays of adjudication would clearly separate out property crimes, and I would be willing to look at perhaps some additional adjustments to the bill as well.
Okay, do you have any testifiers? Caroline Palmer? Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Caroline Palmer. I'm the Public and Legal Affairs Manager at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And I'm here today to address this bill and to thank Representative Loon for bringing up this topic and this conversation, particularly interested in how this applies to instances of sexual abuse in our schools. I'd just first like to acknowledge how much regard we have at MnCASA for educators, and we know the instances in which sexual abuse occurs in the schools are very rare. But we do believe it's very important that we have strong background checks and opportunities to find out about histories of misconduct with regard to sexual abuse so that we are making sure that our students are as safe as possible in school. I also wanted to address one point Representative Hillstrom brought up in the Civil Law Committee with regard to domestic abuse convictions that are outlined here in the bill. And there are instances in which there could be a victim who was convicted of a domestic abuse charge where actually they were the victim. And so maybe as the conversations are continuing around this bill, there could be a look at the expungement laws that lay out how somebody who was actually may have been convicted but was actually a victim is able to prove the circumstances that led to that conviction, and maybe that's a conversation that can happen too. I just want to say over the years we've heard of many instances in which sexual abuse of students by teachers or volunteers, coaches have fallen through the cracks, and so we really appreciate this opportunity to have the conversation. I appreciate everything Representative Loon has done to open this up, and thank you for your work here in the committee, and if I can answer any questions, please let me know.
Thank you. Next is Meg Luger. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Meg Luger-Nicolai. I work with Education Minnesota as an attorney, and I'd like to start by thanking Representative Loon. We've been working with her and speaking with her about this bill for a number of weeks, and I appreciate that the A7 amendment reflects concerns that have been raised in prior committees and in conversations also, I imagine, with Representative Hillstrom. So we really appreciate taking those into account. Just want to raise some of the kind of ongoing concerns that we have, just ensuring that the question of cost sharing or cost bearing with respect to ongoing background checks, it sounds like as discussions go on, if that is something that lands with the board of Pelsby, that would be great and I think cost effective in our view. Additionally, just want to really reiterate a concern about making sure that when we're including offenses in the auto revocation section that we're mindful about what those are. We believe that the A7 amendment represents a step forward in trying to focus the attention on predatory crimes for which there is research-based consensus, I think, on the likelihood of possible recidivism. I think there are other crimes that are currently in that category for which the research doesn't necessarily bear that out, and we should be a little bit more granular about making those permissive as opposed to automatic revocation crimes. And I think specifically in talking about theft, you know, the incident that Representative Loon discusses with respect to the teacher who stole money in Wisconsin, you know, that there's a broader context there. And we hear about the crime, but we don't hear that individual paid his debt to society, and that individual is beloved by the school community in which he currently works. And so I appreciate Representative Loon's sentiment concerning the possibility of redemption. But she and I don't think see completely eye to eye on the question of whether or not something should permanently debar someone from being in a classroom when they have redeemed themselves in all other aspects of their behavior. And I think that goes to another concern that we have to think about, which is that criminality isn't reduced by making people unemployable or less unemployable. I'd also like to reiterate Representative Pinto's concern concerning the look back, especially if we're not going to be granular about the level of the crime. So we do need to think critically about whether or not we've got individuals who are teaching and have otherwise a reliance interest on this license, which is a monopoly provided by the state, right? You guys grant them licenses, you can take them away. And if the state uses its power to take this license away from someone in a way that they couldn't predict it, you know, that's not a very good use of state power. And so I can appreciate that some of my friends on this side of the room, I hope, will kind of take that to heart. And then finally, we'd just like to note that we are more than willing to continue talking about this and continue refining this. And I think one of the concerns that I have globally, and this is a drafting issue, is some of the things that are in the statute right now are cross-referenced statutes which contain sort of a blunderbuss collection of other chapters of or sections of 609. We could probably put together a table or something that identifies exactly which crimes we're talking about and maybe identify which ones we think are of greatest concern in terms of recidivism and in terms of what might compromise safety for students, because that is something upon which there is unanimous agreement that is the most important concern. Thank you.
Is there anybody in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony. And this is to the bill author and maybe a larger question in general of what we do here at the legislature. I know in the past we've talked to the issue of higher education, and when individuals go through certain types of programs, that the advisement for those types of programs at different colleges and universities and other schools go through the process of actually interviewing the individual who is going into a field that would require some type of licensure. So I would assume, maybe I'm assuming wrong, that this then would put in place a process by which all schools that go through a degree program that involves education, where people become teachers, would now need to sort of update the whole list of things that they would have to counsel or advise individuals who are thinking about that field to go into. Am I understanding this correctly? So it goes beyond just, you know, the current issue of people licensing and their renewals, but we now also have to go back to those individuals that might be applying at a university that gives teacher certificates where they can apply for licensure, to actually begin to counsel individuals that are coming in that, you know, say, did you have any type of misdemeanor theft, you know, as an adult going through this. I'm just trying to understand the totality of what we're doing here versus just what this bill is explaining. And if you could answer that, that'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dean. I actually don't know the answer to your question whether or not teacher preparation programs review with teacher candidates in their programs the types of things that would show up in your background check and what would disqualify you from teaching or not. I guess I don't have any firsthand knowledge of whether that is discussed in a teacher prep program, but I would be happy to find out and let you know in the committee know.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Moon, I think it would be important to have that up front so that someone doesn't spend 4 years going to college only to find out that they can't teach in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Dean, I also agree. When I went through law enforcement training, they did that. Mm-hmm. They no longer do those things at the colleges. So we have people that are actually going to take the post-test, get license eligible, but they're not qualified to have a license.
Sure.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lynn, I think we all agree that the bulk of this bill is really needed. The parts about the sexual misconduct, the domestic abuse, I would hazard a guess that 100% of the people in this room are strongly behind you. I would hate to see it get bogged down on some of these ancillary concerns, but for somebody that is in the teaching field and doing a good job, they are not minor things. I'm hoping that those things can be taken care of. Again, to equate a shoplifting charge when somebody was 18 to those other things, I just don't think is reasonable. But the bulk of your bill is necessary, and I think we're all behind that. So if we can get that taken care of, I think you'd have 100% of us behind you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bloom, any final comments?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the comments from the committee, and I would leave this to the discretion of the chair. If we'd like to lay this bill over, I'd be happy to come back after the break. I think we can still do this after the break and meet our deadline in looking at some of those property crimes. I am mindful of that. I think with regards to the look back for people currently teaching, I think there could be things in the background that maybe doesn't show up that would still cause concern, but I think perhaps we could narrow some of those things from the comments made here today.
Okay. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to respond to Representative Keene's question about the schools. And my daughter, just really quickly, my daughter is in a healthcare program right now, radiology. And before she was even admitted into the program, they did a full background check because, of course, as you know, healthcare is very restrictive as to who's allowed to do it because you're working with vulnerable people. So before she was even accepted into the program, they did a full background check. So I would assume that if we do something like this to this extent with teachers, that they would have that conversation up front. Healthcare does, and you just had said law enforcement does. So I would think that they would, and if they don't now, they probably will now.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Do you have any last? Representative Wilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to give you some advice. As Representative Loon said, that she'd be happy to allow us to lay it on the table. I would actually encourage you to do that. I think there is a way to structure this bill to do look-back periods for the offenses we've been talking about without doing look-back periods on the serious offenses that Representative Moon has laid out in her bill. I mean, I think there are ways to craft this to get to where Representative Loon wants to go without marking people forever that we try so hard to rehabilitate and allow to do other professions.
Representative Wilson, that's what I was planning to do, and I was going to see if you'd be willing to work with her to fix those issues.
Happy to, Mr. Chair.
Okay, with that, any last comments?
No, just, you know, I thank the chair. I think this is probably the first bill I've ever presented before public safety. It's not usually a committee that I'm before. I just want to thank the members for their comments. And again, this has been a bill that I think it was very important, but it has been shaped by comments brought forward by stakeholders, and I am listening and trying to be responsive to that. I don't know if we'll be in 100% agreement at the end of the day, but I think we'll probably get closer. And so I'm more than willing to work with members on maybe refining this a little bit with the comments that you have made in mind. So,
thank you. And with that, the chair will lay the bill on the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members.
Next, we have House File 3693, Representative Smith. The chair will move House File 3693 to be referred to the General Register. And Representative Smith, welcome to the committee. And I see you do have an A1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, yes, I do.
Could you explain that amendment for us?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. The A1 amendment is an attempt to further clarify and seek some additional language around the intent of the bill in regard to labor organizations. And, Mr. Chair, we are not all the way there yet. There are still some concerns with this element of the bill that we can talk about later if the committee would like. But I still would like to offer this amendment to the committee for adoption.
All those in favor of the A1, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The amendment is adopted. Representative Smith, please go ahead with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Current law in Minnesota provides penalties and the opportunity to pursue damages from individuals who trespass on or damage critical infrastructure. House File 3693 provides the opportunity to pursue through vicarious liability damages against those entities or individuals who recruit, train, educate, or entice individuals to either trespass or damage critical infrastructure. The bill also uses the concepts from Minnesota's aiding and abetting statute to clarify that criminal charges can also be brought against a person who intentionally recruits, trains, educates, or entices others to trespass or damage critical infrastructure. I have a couple of testifiers that I'd like to speak to the bill, if it's okay, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Could Cam Witten from the Minnesota Chamber please come down?
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Witten. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Cam Winton. I'm the Director of Energy Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, as you may know, is the state's largest trade association. We're comprised of 2,300 businesses. Between them, those businesses have 500,000 employees. We support this bill. We support this bill because it's aimed at deterring and holding accountable people who would do damage to critical infrastructure, infrastructure that all Minnesotans rely on every day. Specifically, the bill would deter and hold accountable people for their choices and their actions. Not their thoughts, not their speech, but their actions. So specifically, let me highlight the three things that this bill does. First, it creates civil liability in addition to the existing criminal liability for people who do damage to critical infrastructure. Secondly, it sets penalties for recruiters at the same level as the existing penalties for the people who are recruited. Third and finally, it creates vicarious liability for recruiters. Put simply, if someone works hard to get someone else to go commit a crime, then this bill would hold that recruiter accountable for the foreseeable damage that occurs. Let me emphasize what this bill does not do. This bill does not criminalize anybody's thoughts. This bill does not prohibit anybody's associational rights. Remember that I sit here representing a trade association. I'm very sensitive to people's associational rights. I'm engaging in them right now. This bill doesn't do that. And if I could build on a comment that Representative Dean made, Mr. Chair, regarding another bill, and I know that Representative Dean opposes this bill, but I appreciated his comment earlier that this committee is capable of structuring bills that address the problem at hand without going too far afield. And I submit for your consideration, members of the committee, that this bill does exactly that. It deters and holds people accountable for their bad actions that harm all of Minnesota without impacting speech and associational rights. And for those reasons, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce supports this bill.
Thank you. Next testifier.
Yes, Bill Hefner, please, Mr. Chair.
And I believe John Gordon will be on deck. Welcome to committee. Mr. Hefner, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is William Hefner, H-E-F-N-E-R. I'm with the law firm of the Environmental Law Group in Mendota Heights. I'm here at the request of the American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers. I'd like to make a couple of points for the committee members to consider as they review and consider this bill. And I'm going to keep my comments focused on the criminal statutes, portions of the bill, which are the purview of this committee. First of all, just to set some context for this, and I apologize if this sounds pedantic. I don't mean it to be, but I do want to first talk about the context of the bill here. Minnesota Statute 609 includes two levels of trespass. There is what I will call normal trespass, which prohibits someone from encroaching on their neighbor's yard or from hunting on a farm without permission. That's normal trespass. But this legislature, in its wisdom years ago, determined that there are portions of our society that we need to be particularly careful and protective of, and those are our critical infrastructure facilities and delivery mechanisms. They are the backbone of our modern society. They provide our heat, our electricity, our communications, our fuels. This legislature decided years ago that those portions of our society deserve particular protection against trespass and created these existing statutes, 609, 594, and 6055, specifically to discourage the destruction and invasion of those critical components of our society. So those are laws that already exist. It is already illegal for an individual to invade without permission critical infrastructure facilities. It is already illegal to destroy portions of those, of that infrastructure. This bill does not create an entirely new concept. That concept already exists, which is the one I just spoke of, which is the protection of the critical infrastructure. This bill merely discourages the encouragement of those who would violate these existing laws. So it is, again, not creating out of whole cloth an entirely new concept. It is merely expanding to discourage criminal behavior. There's been concern expressed that this is an invasion of free speech and free assembly. I'd agree with Mr. Winton that I don't believe that this does this, particularly if you look at the definition of critical public service facility in 6055. It is a narrow definition that includes buildings and structures and fenced-in areas. A person who wants to picket can still do so at the outside of these buildings, outside of these fences. This bill does not discourage that, or does not prohibit that, I should say. So, therefore, you know, people can still rally and speak in areas that the existing law already allows them to do. This would not discourage that. To use an admittedly extreme example, and please, I'm not trying to draw moral equivalency here in my example, so please take this in the spirit that is offered. But if tomorrow we were to learn that some individuals had entered into a transformer facility of one of our utilities and had destroyed that and wiped out power for a significant swath of the community, obviously we want to hold those individuals accountable. But if we were to learn that there was an organization that specifically recruited, trained, funded, and encouraged those individuals to do that, I think we would all agree that we would also want to find a way to put a stop to that, to prevent that continued violation of existing law. As further way to address concerns that I know have reasonably been raised, that, well, what if we're in an organization that we are training individuals in peaceful protest, and one of our rogue members goes off and goes into part of the facility we didn't ask them to, we didn't encourage them to do, or they do some destruction that we did not encourage them to do, we're going to be held responsible for that. again, the bill as it's currently written, I think, is very careful to avoid that sort of inadvertent association. The bill says that a person has to intentionally recruit, train, etc., an individual for the specific purpose of violating the existing law. If a person's actions with regard to another person who violated the law fall short of that, they cannot be prosecuted under this bill as it's currently written. And with that, I believe that's the end of my prepared comments.
Thank you. All right. Mr. Gordon? And on deck will be Leanne Weichler.
Mr. Chair, can I ask that last fire just a quick question?
Because of time, I'd like to have questions at the end after all the testifiers, if that is okay.
Okay.
Mr. Gordon, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is John Gordon. I'm the Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Minnesota. As many of you know, we are a nonpartisan, nonprofit Minnesota organization with more than 44,000 supporters across the state of Minnesota, and we're devoted to protecting the civil liberties of the people of Minnesota. We ask this morning that you not support House File 3693 for three reasons. One, the bill is unnecessary. Two, the bill is unwise. And three, the bill is unconstitutional. It is unnecessary, despite the fact that it is reasonable, and we understand that it is reasonable to want to protect critical infrastructure in this state from being damaged or interfered with. That is a reasonable goal for this committee and for this legislature. But as has already been pointed out to some extent, there is already a statute providing for criminal trespass. There is a specific statute for criminal trespass in critical public service facilities. There is a statute criminalizing damage to property, and a special statute criminalizing damage to property in these critical facilities. But there is more that has not been mentioned. There is a doctrine of civil conspiracy in the law of the state of Minnesota that already exists. There is a statute criminalizing criminal conspiracy, and there is a statute criminalizing aiding and abetting. So we have already got laws on our books in this state that get to people who are not necessarily at the scene, but who are still engaged in criminal activity because they have engaged in a conspiracy or because they are aiding and abetting. Those are laws that apply not just to a particular industry or a particular set of facilities, but are designed to protect all of the people in the state of Minnesota, not just a special interest group. As I understand it, there have been no complaints from law enforcement that they lack the tools to achieve the goals, the mandatory goals that are in this statute. The tools are not lacking from law enforcement's point of view, nor are the tools lacking to impose civil liability on people who cause damages to other people. I have tried cases in front of judges and juries across this state, from Couchiching County to Olmsted County to St. Louis County to Rockta County. And in my experience, the judges and juries in this state, with the laws that are already on the books and the doctrines that are already part of our common law, do a pretty good job of figuring out who ought to pay money to whom because they've committed some wrong or damage. They don't always get it right in my experience, but very, very frequently they get it right. And there are well-settled rules in this state for vicarious liability. That is, when one person should be held responsible for the actions of another person. Those are laws that are existing. Judges are familiar with them, and they know how to conduct trials based on those principles. And those apply to everybody, not just special interest groups. So, number one, we think the statute is unnecessary. Number two, the statute is unwise. It is vague. It's going to create a lot of litigation. It is unwise because it imposed liability on people who have been arrested, just arrested. It imposes both criminal and civil liability on people who have been arrested. Respectfully, that's not the way it works in this state. That's not the way it works, and that's not the way it's supposed to work. Arresting officers are supposed to be able to do their job of enforcing the criminal law without being concerned about the civil liability, which is better left to lawyers and private litigants. It is outsourcing the goals to private lawyers and corporations, and respectfully, it is worded in a way that judges and juries in this state will not understand. Section A talks about people who are arrested or convicted for damages while trespassing. It doesn't say damages caused by anybody or damages resulting from the trespassing or anything else. It says damages while trespassing. Respectfully, I don't know what that means, and I don't think judges and juries will know it either. Section B talks about damages committed by an individual arrested or convicted. That is a unique statute in the state of Minnesota. Damages are not committed. Crimes are committed. Damages are caused by or result or whatever. So wherever the origin of the wording in the statute came from, I suggest to you that it is not wording that judges and juries in the state of Minnesota are going to understand. Third, it is unconstitutional. The term was used foreseeable in summarizing the statute. The term foreseeable is not in this statute, I respectfully point out. And I also would point out that, as the prior witness said, it is designed to discourage encouragement. That was the phraseology you just heard. It is designed to discourage encouragement. The fact is that the statutes that are on the books in terms of aiding and abetting and conspiracy do get to communications, but they don't get to free speech and free assembly and free association the way this bill does. The verbs that are in this bill are recruit, train, aid, advise, hire, counsel, and conspire. Now, some of that stuff, conspire, for example, is already in the statutes and not necessary. But some of it, in terms of advising and counseling, people are not going to understand what that means, and they are going to have their rights to speech and assembly discouraged in just the way that the prior witness said. So it is vague in the way that it imposes vicarious liability. It is overbroad, and I think it is designed to interfere with protesting, which is an important part of the history of this state and this nation. And really imposes guilt by association. So I urge you not to support this bill. Let's not fall victim to special interest groups who would interfere with well-settled Minnesota law. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Next we have Leanne Watkins, and on deck is Scott Russell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Leanne Watkins. I'm a priest in the Episcopal tradition, and actually, ironically, right exactly now, I should be kneeling in front of my bishop at the cathedral, renewing my ordination vows for the 24th time. I'm not doing that because this measure before you has caused me concern and put them in conflict with my actual ordination vows. For me, actually, it's my baptismal promises that are more important. The baptismal promises we make in the Episcopal tradition tell us to respect the dignity of every human being and work for freedom, justice, and peace. I love our country, I love our democracy, and I value our right to freedom of assembly and freedom of speech. And so those two things go quite well together in my mind, and historically, all the great movements of our country that have brought us more closer to the ideals that we profess have been backed, trained, conspired by faith traditions, of all the major faith traditions we have. And the major value I hold of nonviolence is a primary motivator for me to do all the things that are listed in this bill. Now, here's what I do with my life. My job is through preaching and teaching and relying on historic traditions to equip and train people to live out their values with the tools they have and the context they have in this country that's in our democracy. And so what do? I recruit, I train, I teach meditation, I teach de-escalation skills, we teach civic conversations, we teach how our democracy works, we teach how the ideology of a God that loves everybody equally and encourages us to work for the freedom and peace and dignity of every person. We're training and equipping and conspiring to do that all the time. And so it's those words that got me a little concerned in here. These words like recruit, train, educate, entice, equip, and this really chilling statement of vicarious liability. I agree with the former speaker. It's kind of vague. Am I vicariously liable? For instance, if I have a spiritual counseling session with someone who wants to pair their religious beliefs and their civic obligations, and then later goes to somewhere and something goes sideways, they aren't able to fulfill that peaceful, lawful assembly thing they started off to do. Am I vicariously liable for that? If we send a casserole to a meeting, are we vicariously liable? If I allow the March for Our Lives kids to meet in my congregation, if we give them a check for the bus ride to D.C., am I vicariously liable if something had gone sideways in D.C.? This is really concerning to me, because if we want our democracy to work, it takes skill. It takes skill, it takes maturity, it takes an overriding ideology of, for instance, nonviolence in order to counter that emotional reactivity that can happen in the moment. It takes a maturity of meditation and prayer to be able to de-escalate those internal feelings, de-escalate in a personal conflict in order to stay peaceful and stay lawful. So if we value those things, if we value peaceful, lawful assembly.
I hate to cut you short, but we still have more testifiers and we're down to about 6 minutes.
I have one sentence.
Thank you.
This feels counterproductive, exasperatingly counterproductive, and I encourage you to vote no.
Thank you
for your time.
Mr. Russell. Thank you. And up next after that is Misty Babineau, I believe. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Russell.
Start.
Please introduce yourself and start with your testimony. You can please keep it to about 2 minutes. We would appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Scott Russell, and I'm here today testifying for the Sierra Club North Star chapter, where I'm proudly an active member and a volunteer leader. We represent more than 20,000 members statewide, and we strongly oppose this legislation. I began volunteering with the Sierra Club specifically because of the indigenous rights issues raised by Enbridge Line 3 and my concerns over climate change. I am deeply concerned that my involvement with an issue advocacy organization like the Sierra Club could expose me to liability through no fault of my own should this bill become law. For example, if my volunteer activities happen to include organizing an event where they present information critical of Line 3, and someone attending this event is later arrested for trespassing, this bill would appear to expose both the organization and myself as a volunteer to potential liability. Thus, simply providing information or public advocacy critical of so-called critical infrastructure projects constitute the type of aiding, advising, or counseling described in the bill? As others have said, I would agree, it's not clear to me and it's deeply concerning. It is not reasonable to expect that members of the public who volunteer their time to advocate on a public policy issue or otherwise peacefully assemble should be expected to bear liability for anyone's actions other than their own. We should be encouraging the public to participate in exercise their free speech rights, not discouraging it by adding additional penalties for trespassing that are broad and unclear. Many organizations agree with this, as you can see from the letter that many organizations signed, and that letter is in your packet. This bill would have a chilling effect on free speech and peaceful freedom of assembly and should be opposed. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Next testifier. If you could please state your name for the record and proceed. And welcome to the committee.
My name is Mr. Bevan. And Chair, I have a question for point of clarity. Is it like 3 minutes left for everybody's combined testimony?
We have session at noon, and we're supposed to be done in 4 minutes.
I would like to cede my time to Tara Huska. Is that acceptable, sir?
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
That is the last testifier that we've had signed up for today. Please state your name for the record. Just a reminder, we do have a number of members that also have questions for some of the testifiers as well.
Sure. My name is Tara Hauska. I'm here testifying on behalf of Honor the Earth and as a concerned Minnesota citizen. So Congress shall make no law abridging the right of people to peacefully assemble, petition the government for a redress of grievances. That law is absolute. The law that the bill that's before the committee today would chip away at those values, demean the framework of democracy, and create a slippery slope of uncertainty regarding fundamental rights. HF 3693 is misguided and dangerous. We cannot strip away democracy simply because we do not agree with the issues being asserted. Section 1B would hold a person or entity that recruits, trains, advises, hires, counsels, or conspires with or otherwise procures another to trespass vicariously liable. In other words, anyone engaged in constitutionally protected free speech and demonstration could be held liable for the actions of a single individual. Is our legislature now actively engaged in opening the door to a slippery slope of any form of organized protest? Section 1B does exactly that. Trespass requires intent. The physical act of trespass and knowing, usually provided by a posted sign or a verbal warning of a police officer or someone on site, that you're going to be committing trespass if you stay. How can a citizen be guilty for the individual trespass of another? We already have laws in place that address this issue. Citizens have been engaging in constitutional protests since the founding of the United States. This often includes trespass or intentional occupation, which in turn leaves individuals with the option of either criminal prosecution facing those charges or leaving the site. That is the most basic form of protest. This is an assault on our democracy by lobbyists of a foreign oil corporation. The freedom to assemble is an absolute right. The founders of the U.S. did not include limitations on assembly organizers or more severe punishments for protests on a certain type of issue. The fact that he's included an exemption for labor unions further emphasizes both recognition that there are constitutional issues present, and again, that this right is absolute and impartial. It should not be made an exception just for a certain type of group. Everyone has these basic fundamental rights. We all have citizens have foundational rights. Minnesota already has trespassing laws. It has a robust criminal code. I spent 6 months in North Dakota. I watched 800 cases brought in front of the North Dakota courts. 800 charges were brought. We still have 300 cases left. Their criminal code was clearly able to address what was happening as far as people choosing to engage in trespass, people choosing to engage in constitutionally protected free speech, people choosing to engage in conspiracy. Those laws are already on the books. I'm hoping that Minnesota does not make the same mistakes that North Dakota did. It's actually pretty bizarre to me to be over here as a Minnesota citizen using almost identical testimony that I went and used in North Dakota, almost the same exact bill, also brought forth by a special interest group. We must always be vigilant and scrutinize any law or regulation for even the slightest potential to hinder or diminish our constitutional rights. HF 3693 fails to pass the test of absolute democracy. I urge this committee not to pass this deeply troubling bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Smith, do you have any comments after hearing the testimony?
No, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Smith. And I just need to make a comment to Mr. Renton. I don't think this is narrow enough to actually be doing what we hope to do. I'm going to start with a question around our statute, or the statute that would say that anyone who is arrested could be held liable, and anybody who is vicariously connected to that person who is held liable. Is there anywhere else in our statute that if someone is just arrested, not convicted, that we actually hold them liable or vicariously liable through an individual who may have been arrested? Is there anywhere else in our statute that we actually do that?
Representative Smith?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would defer to staff for the interpretation of the codes on that for our other statutes.
I don't know if they need a little bit of time because I've got a few other comments.
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I don't believe that anywhere in statute we specifically say that someone who's arrested would be civilly liable. However, under the concept of civil liability, there would not be a requirement that somebody be convicted of a crime to be civilly liable, for example, for other trespasses, for negligence, for assault. There's no actual requirement that those people be convicted of a crime.
Okay, and thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Johnson. So there's no way where we actually call it out as someone could be civilly liable. It's because of the absence where we don't actually spell it out that they're not liable.
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would need to do a full review of all the statutes to answer that definitively, but I'm not aware of any of them.
Okay. Mr. Chair, thank you, and Representative Smith. So I'm thinking of a scenario that where I'm working for Clean Water Action, and I'm standing on a corner in Northeast Minneapolis, and I'm asking people to sign up and get engaged with Clean Water Action. So I'm recruiting, right? And this individual then goes through a process, and ultimately they do something 2 years down the road that they're arrested for, and, you know, it's not my case, but let's just say that I was from a fairly wealthy family, and the interests of these individuals were able to find through a string that I was actually the person that signed this individual up on a street corner to get engaged with an organization. I'd be liable under this bill, it seems. And this is where I think it goes way, way too far. I think of so many things in this, and I want to believe that this is intended to hold the people liable that caused damage, because that's what you're talking about. But I actually think this bill has another intent. And that intent is to separate allies who support the efforts of people, whether it's saving the earth or whether it's rightfully protesting around issues of injustice throughout our society. And I actually think this intent of this bill is to try to scare away allies that actually have some resources to not engage with individuals so that justice can come in our society. So I'm really, really concerned. I'll be voting against this.
Thank you. Representative Smith, do you have any comments on that, or do you want
just briefly, Mr. Chair, if I could, and I'll be short because I know there's some other questions and discussion that's going to be needed. But Representative, I respectfully disagree with the intent and your interpretation and the example that you gave. It is meant to be narrowly focused, and if the individual or the organization, if their intent is to harm critical infrastructure, then there would be liability, and I would argue that the case that you outlined, there would not be, but obviously there would be many variables to that case that maybe, that our discussion might not be able to, you know, give credence to.
So if I can just respond really quickly.
Dean, we have four other people who wish to testify, and we're down to 5 minutes.
This will be very quick. I believe that the criminal part of this addresses intent, but the civil part of this does not address intent.
That issue is addressed in civil law. We're going to just deal with the criminal side, please. Representative Hirschman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I was going to deal with the civil liability as well. It is clear that in the criminal portion, you put intentionally recruits and trains, and in the civil portion, you did not put intentional. I believe that what this would do is create a situation where if I knew there was going to be an event and I was supportive, and I created a Facebook page and invited people to come to that event because I was supportive, and someone who I recruited to come acted out in a way that caused that damage or trespass, that I would be liable. Now, I didn't ask them to go and do damage, but I certainly participated in the recruitment of getting people to be there. So I really believe that this is sweeping, and I know that you offered an amendment based on my comments in civil law surrounding labor unions. It's my understanding that you're still having conversations with those folks about that issue. But members, folks have been fighting for their rights and making dissentful protests
for generations, and that is kind of one of the founding things that we allow people to do here. And I would encourage folks to vote no on this. I believe that this really is, this really goes way, way too far, and it is not narrowly crafted, and the civil liability portions do not reflect the language we use here under Minnesota law. And so I'm not sure where that language came from, but it is not clear, and it holds an awful lot of people responsible for things they had no idea was going to happen.
Representative Beckerson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when the bill was originally explained, some of the earlier testifiers talked about that this was aimed at people who damage infrastructure, and that's clearly false. What it explicitly does is extend the criminal and civil liabilities to additional people besides the people who damage infrastructure. That is, you know, that's already illegal. We already have criminal statutes that deal with that. And we also heard, you know, Representative Smith use the words educate and entice, and neither of those words, out of the eight verbs that are in the bill, neither of those verbs are in there. So again, because I think people really need to understand this, is recruits, trains, aids, advises, hires, counsels, or conspires with or otherwise procures is enormously broad. And I know there's been some other examples stated, and I really think that this bill, along with some of the other bills that we've heard, really show a pattern of trying to silence dissent. And I know previous testifiers have said, you know, that's not the intent, but that will be the outcome of something this broad. Because if attending a meeting with someone or contributing to an online message board, if retweeting something, liking something on a Facebook post, when I talked to some of the folks who were promoting this bill yesterday, they said, well, that'll be up to the courts to decide. Well, that's exactly what's going to keep people from participating in dialogue and their freedom of speech and freedom to assemble if it's not clear whether they could be held liable. I mean, that's going to keep people from exercising their rights. And, you know, we talk about the Constitution all the time, and we especially talk about the Second Amendment, but this has some really serious implications for the First Amendment and absolutely seems aimed at silencing dissent, which is one of the least American things we could possibly do. So, obviously, I will be a no vote on this, and I just... I encourage folks to look at the actual language in the bill, because it is clearly aimed at people outside of the people who actually intentionally do the damage. So, thank you.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make it quick. I was going to have questions, but there's no time for that. So, Representative Smith, I thank you for bringing this bill. A couple things I wanted to just straighten out. I've heard a couple times now the use of the word democracy. First of all, we live in a republic, not a democracy. Second, there was the use of that we have the right to peacefully assemble. That is incorrect. We have the right to peacefully assemble when it's not engaged in criminal behavior. Peaceful is the exact opposite of criminal activity. So a person cannot go on private property and consider that peacefully assembly. And then third, addressing some of the comments about recruiting clipboards, Facebook, sharing, things like that. As I read your language, it says, recruits, trains, aids, advises, hires, counsels, conspires, or otherwise procure to trespass. And so unless a person is recruiting somebody to engage in the criminal behavior of trespass, they would not be roped in and unintentionally forfeit their constitutional rights. Thank you, Representative Smith.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a bunch of questions about this, Darwin, just with a brief comment. So the more I look at this bill, Representative Smith, the more problematic it seems. Pretty much on every single line, I have to agree with the comments of the gentleman from the ACLU. We have we have hundreds of years, we talked about before, a careful balance to say, when are you liable for something that somebody else does? And what this bill does is it either just repeats that, in which case there's no point to it superfluous, and it seems to be some of the implications to it yet, or it extends that principle out to brand new areas. And the way that we can believe that it has to do with dissent is because it does so with regard to specific error. So I'm trying to understand why this principle, if this bill does extend this, would not apply in the case of if someone is, let's say, trespassing or having some sort of damage to a facility that provides reproductive services in some form, abortion, some other controversial topic. And so we picked this one particular topic and had, and are really making these changes, which, as we say, we're not even quite sure what they are, but I think can get us into some really problematic areas. It is notable to me as a prosecutor that we don't hear from law enforcement. We've not heard a single testify from law enforcement. And it really is quite unclear as to exactly what this would do, except that it would apparently extend in some way beyond the principles that we have right now that says, when am I guilty of aiding and abetting or conspiring? And I've charged those cases a number of times. And when am I not guilty of aiding and abetting or conspiring, and yet I am somehow guilty of or liable for some other thing that would not qualify in those other areas? I think we need to be extremely careful in making those kinds of changes, and I do not see this bill as being extremely careful. So I too am a no. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair? A brief comment. And to a lot of the really to all the comments there, this is meant to be a consensus bill, and I have a reputation of working with people and trying to have a bill that people can support. And from the last committee was born an amendment that maybe isn't all the way there, but we're working towards it. So to everyone, I offer, as I always do, to talk about the clarity and try to bring the true intent of what this bill is trying to stop, which is damage to critical infrastructure. And perhaps there isn't time and the chair can make this decision, but critical infrastructure is specifically defined by many things, and the example you gave, Representative, is not one of them. So the example you gave is outside the scope of this bill.
Representative Zeroz.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members and Representative Smith. I think this is an unbelievably important piece of legislation. I think any time we're enticing or encouraging or recruiting groups of individuals to violate the law, to enter into private property and to cause damage to someone else's property, especially critical infrastructure, you have no First Amendment right to break stuff. You have no First Amendment right to violate private property rights. If you think you do, you're confused. And so we need to hold those individuals accountable. I think this bill does a great job of doing that. I wish you all the luck with the bill.
And with that, I will renew my motion to re-refer this.
Mr. Chair, I'd request a roll call.
A roll call has been requested. I will re-refer House File 3693 to the General Register as amended. Fourth, let's proceed with the roll call.
Johnson.
Yes.
Lohmeyer.
Yes.
Hillstrom.
No.
Becker Finn.
No.
Considine.
No.
Dean.
No.
Frankie.
Yes.
Grosso.
Yes.
Howe. Lucero.
Yes.
Neuberger.
Aye.
O'Neill.
Yes.
Pinto.
No.
Uglin.
Yes.
Ward.
No.
Zerwas.
Yes.
And the bill passed 9-6. And we will be adjourned. Yep.